Blaine Authority. We have Brian Jeffries, the director, and welcome, Director Jeffries. Please introduce if you have anyone with you, or and we'll get underway.
Mr. Chairman.
The sneeze button.
Sneeze button. Mr. Chairman, I'm by myself today.
All right. Fire away.
Having listened to the manner of presentation earlier today, if it pleases you, Mr. Chairman, I would just go to page 8 of our budget package to walk through and use it as the tool to walk through what we're doing and how we made the cuts and the influences the cuts have on us and how we plan to go forward.
I think that'll work. Just give us a brief synopsis of your agency, you know, who you are, how long you've been doing it, what you do, real quick.
Mr. Chairman, we are Wyoming's voice for an avenue to seek better prices for gas produced in Wyoming and to look after the interests of Wyoming in adequate pipeline capacity to get Wyoming oil and gas products to market and to get them there with the highest possible price so that we can increase tax revenues for the state of Wyoming. That's the reason the Pipeline Authority was created, to do things that preserve access to markets, improve access to markets, raise prices, assist those who want to develop facilities in Wyoming that will consume gas in Wyoming and create added value within the state. Being an enterprise that understands commercially and physically how the natural gas grid operates and be there and be available to those who have questions about how do I site a project in Wyoming and where can I get gas and what are the rules of the road. To assist people in developing projects in Wyoming, whether that is new production in Wyoming that wants to understand how it would get out of the state and get to market, or new consumers, such as Standard Alcohol that was in the papers a few days back, that want to site in Wyoming and understand how things work. These are activities. They're not done by any other state agency. The Public Service Commission is not involved in the management or regulation of interstate pipelines. That's a Federal Energy Regulatory Commission activity exclusively. There are 14 interstate pipelines located in Wyoming. They're part of a grid in the U.S. of 100-plus interstate pipelines. So for a state of Wyoming so heavily dependent upon the movement of natural gas in particular, we provide the overview and the opportunity and the vehicle to support pipeline projects and pipeline proposals before the FERC that are to our benefit and to oppose those that are to our detriment. Again, that's not a review of federal activities or pipeline activities conducted by the Public Service Commission because they don't regulate interstate pipelines, and it is not a matter before the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. So, you know, looking after the interests of Wyoming akin to what a marketing department would do for a major oil and gas producer is the primary function of the Pipeline Authority.
Great. Please proceed.
Going to page 8, then, of our budget, a couple things to point out. We are not in the state personnel system, so all the salary and employee costs appear in the 900 line for the Pipeline Authority. And so, essentially, the amount that you see there down there for contractual services, $854,000 for the biennium, is employee costs. That's salaries, benefits, et cetera. The balance of our expenditures are up in the 200 lines where the sort of the customary elements that go with running an operation. We have two full-time employees and two part-time employees. So as an organization, we're far closer to a one-man short basketball team than a football team with an extra quarterback and an extra punter. The four people that do work for the Pipeline Authority have distinct roles and do distinct jobs. We don't have overlap within the organization. So as we have gone through the two rounds of budget cutting, if you will, we have addressed it through dramatic reductions in the 200 line expenditures. If we cut further, we will try to stay away from cutting hours if we can, because we do have part-time employees, two of them. I'm reluctant to do that if I can stay away from it because we tend to run the risk of driving those part-time employees away if they see that this is a compared to their next best alternative, a full-time employment somewhere else, losing employees in a four-person shop, it's very hard to replace people and get them up to speed. It's a small group. So our cuts have been represented sort of across the lines there for the 200 series things that go with running an organization. The two biggest things we have cut, though, is travel. I have not been out of state since we got into the budget cutting mode. So in-state and out-of-state travel has been dramatically cut. And another key feature coming from last year's round of required budget cuts, we have substantially eliminated legal expenditures. The work we do before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission requires typically outside counsel because it's a very specialized feature of law, arguments, administrative law before the FERC. We have reached an agreement with the governor's office last year that when we identify a significant issue before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission where the Wyoming Pipeline Authority should be present and should be making an argument, we will go back to the governor's office, explain the particular issue at hand, what we think the expected legal expenditures would be to participate in the process, make the case that the expenditure is worthwhile for the issue at hand, and they would seek to find discretionary funds within their budget to specifically support that. So we have, going through the cycle, have essentially wiped out legal expenses for ourselves. How that will play out, we haven't had an opportunity to test that yet to see if we can, if we miss opportunities to participate. When you appear before the FERC, there are often short deadlines from when a proposal is filed to when you have to have a substantive response to the commission. That's often 30 days or less. So the added process of going and seeking permission and getting funding and going through it will make it a little tighter. But as I say, we haven't tried it yet, but that's the plan for that. So other than that, cutting travel, cutting out our interaction with the pipelines. None of the 14 pipeline companies that operate in Wyoming are based in Wyoming. And typically pipeline companies will host at least one meeting a year where they will give a presentation on their planned operations for the year, planned maintenance outages, plans for tariff changes, rate changes, et cetera. It's an excellent opportunity to keep up with what's going on with the pipelines that most directly affect us. We will miss some of those meetings. In fact, we may miss them all. The PowerPoints get posted online. We will do our best to get what we need out of those types of presentations as opposed to in-person participation.
Representative Larson.
Did you say there's 14 interstate lines or operators in the state? Did I hear that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, actually it's 14 with a 15th with a limited certificate style of regulation.
Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your 900 series with all your salaries, why is it not 100? Maybe you said that and I missed it when you were saying.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Driscoll, when the Pipeline Authority was set up, there was a interest, and I think it was actually a requirement, because we have the authority to sell bonds, we could not be literally a state agency. We had to be outside. That kicked us, as a consequence, out of the state personnel system. So the number, the bills, salary bills, wound up in 900. But it all drives from that, not literally a state agency, owing to that bonding requirement.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Co-Chair.
Two questions. One is, you mentioned you deal with oil and gas. What about any finished gasoline lines? Does that count too? There's one that within a couple of miles of mine that's where the tanker trucks go and fill up.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burns, we haven't had an issue come up over finished products pipelines where there's been a case of inadequate capacity or similar issues that drive us to do something. We do track them in our database. The Pipeline Authority maintains a very robust inventory in its geographic information system of all the pipes in the state that we're aware of, including products pipelines. But product pipelines have not stood in the way of a better price for us.
Thank you. And my other question is, how many offices do you have?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burns, we have one in Casper.
And the rent is over $5,500 a month?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burns, I believe that is correct.
For a four-man office?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burns, correct.
Wow.
How long's your lease?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burns, I'm looking at the numbers. So that's $67,000 for 24 months. So I believe that actually comes out to a rent number
that makes
much
more
closer
sense.
To three.
It's still salty, but it isn't dear.
What's the possibility of working out of your home?
Minivan.
Representative Walter.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. With your filings not having the ability to file as many legal briefs as you have in the past and using the governor's office, can you use the attorney general's office within the governor's branch to help you and have somebody from the attorney general's office kind of not necessarily on staff but always somewhat up to speed to where you could file those in an expeditious manner when you say there's a short-term turnaround?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walters, we actually have a memo that goes back to the founding of the Pipeline Authority from the Attorney General's office directing us not to use them for the purpose of maintaining separation as a state agency. We do have a recent example, though, of working with the Attorney General's office. There is a proposed liquefied natural gas export terminal proposed for the coast of Oregon where the Wyoming Pipeline Authority was a participant in the proceeding, as was the state of Wyoming, so discreetly two entities. We actually wrote the brief that was then filed jointly by the Attorney General's office and the Wyoming Pipeline Authority so that there were two voices in that case promoting the project. But it's a highly specialized area of law and relies heavily on precedent. So, for example, in that brief, we are making reference to projects that were proposed in Colorado and administered a certain way by the FERC, a project, I believe, in Louisiana is a comparable. So it would be difficult for the Attorney General's office to stay in sync with rulings of the FERC related to the 100-plus interstate pipelines scattered throughout the country for their precedential impact on a case we might have.
And could you briefly describe the purpose of your bonding authority and what you do and how you use it?
Mr. Chairman, we've never used the bonding authority. It was created by statute for us at a time when the state was particularly short of pipelines, and the perception was that private industry was not stepping up to the plate fast enough to build projects. So the Pipeline Authority does have the statutory capability of owning and operating a pipeline. There are rules that give private industry every opportunity to do it first, but that would have created the financing mechanism for us to fund a construction of a pipeline.
And just to finish up, you don't have any intention or need to do that?
Mr. Chairman, I don't expect us to ever use it.
Yeah. Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jeffries, we approached that close one time, I believe, with a pipeline, and then private sector stepped in and filled it. Could you share that with us?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Representative Larson, are you referring to the Kern River pipeline system? Thank you. So one of the earliest projects and one of the greatest successes for the Wyoming Pipeline Authority and by extension the state of Wyoming is the existence of a pipeline called Kern River Transmission, which runs from the Opal area to the Southern California border. There was a proposal back in the late 80s, early 90s for a pipeline to run from Alberta to Southern California, run through Wyoming, but just sort of run through and say hi, and move Canadian gas to Southern California. The state of Wyoming, through a number of methods and promotion, established it as the state as a reliable source of natural gas for Southern California. The Kern River transmission system ultimately was built instead of a pipeline from Alberta to California. Over the years, the Kern River transmission system has grown to a system that moves over 2 billion cubic feet per day of gas out of Wyoming to Southern California. It runs full nearly every day of the year. It is the largest single export of gas out of the state of Wyoming, and is the cheapest pathway to California from Wyoming, owing to the fact it was built many, many years ago when construction costs are cheaper. Getting that project built in the state of Wyoming, I believe, at one point offered loan guarantees that were never actually used, but promoting to California that Wyoming was a better choice than Canada and succeeding.
And my memory's very clouded, but I used to go back to Washington, D.C. for the AG's office and attend the FERC hearings on Kern River Pipeline a long time ago.
So, Mr. Jeffrey, since we've kind of gone through over the last couple of years with budget reduction, are you finding your ability to I think that you also intervened on a Kinder Morgan issue in Rawlins that kept access from the Wind River Basin open. That was scheduled to close. But have you, with that, have you found instance, do you think you're missing are you restricted on what you've been able to do, and are you looking at the rear-view mirror and saying, oh, crap, we should have been there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, I don't think we have missed anything yet. We have a great deal of institutional knowledge. We have extremely strong and wide contacts through the industry. We're leaning on those for other people to point out something if we miss it that we should have noticed directly. But we may not know we've missed something till we've truly missed it.
And would you mind just briefly sharing us about the Rawlins plant there, that old CIG plant, and their attempt to close that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, the reference there is made to Colorado Interstate Gas Pipeline, which operates a system over a large part of the state, including a pair of pipelines out of the Wind River Lateral, a 16-inch diameter line and a 12-inch diameter line. One of those lines, the 12-inch diameter line, moves unprocessed gas out of the Wind River Basin down to Rawlins, where it was customarily processed. You have to process natural gas that when it comes out of the wellhead, unless it's coal bed methane, and we're referring to natural gas here, it's a combination of methane, ethane, propane, butane, et cetera. For both safety and commercial reasons, you want to segregate essentially the methane from the other products. That is what gas processing does. You also have to do it to meet the gas quality specifications of the rest of the pipeline grid. So historically, gas was moved down this 12-inch line from the Wind River Lateral, roughly about 30,000 MCF a day, processed at Rawlins, made fungible to the pipeline grid and placed into the grid. Colorado Interstate Gas, as part of a larger rate case settlement proposal, proposed to abandon the Rawlins plant. That would render gas coming down that 12-inch line incompatible with the system and unavailable for flow on the system, leaving that production in the Wind River without an opportunity for processing unless new processing was built, and at least for the period of time while waiting for a hoped new processing plant, unavailable for flow. The Pipeline Authority was aware that Colorado Interstate Gas would likely be filing a rate case, that this would be a small part of. We took the opportunity to leverage our support for their global settlement of their rate case, conditioned upon their agreeing to blend that gas with their system at Rawlins in a way that ensured safe operations and continued flow of the gas. Their original plan was to just cast it aside. And it was a small issue in the scheme of things of the rate case, but when you file a rate case settlement, having uniform and unanimous support for the rate case settlement is an important goal. Having a protest to your rate case filing really slogs the process up. The Wyoming Pipeline Authority has, I think, very good bona fides with the FERC on commercial and physical matters, and we use that background to argue for keeping that gas on and coming up with an alternate solution that the rest of the settling parties could support so they could get onto their bigger fish.
Mr. Chairman. Director Jeffries, I'm just trying to understand. We've got two and two, four people. You coordinate with FERC. So how many pipelines altogether are those four people responsible for total?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dockstader, well, we're not a regulatory agency, so we're not responsible in the sense that we can approve or disapprove directly of anything they do. So the 14 pipelines that operate in Wyoming are where, particularly myself, is the one with the particular background in regulatory matters with pipelines. It largely falls to me for regulatory and operational issues of those 14 pipelines to discover and determine the impact of proposals on those pipelines and whether they are beneficial or detrimental to the state of Wyoming, and then determine whether is it big enough to fight over or not.
So, Mr. Chairman, 14 then. 14 is what we're tracking then?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dockstader, we track those 14 principally, but we actually pay attention to developments on all pipelines. As an example, there is a pipeline that runs from the Permian Basin of Texas up to Minnesota. It's called Northern Natural Gas Company. 3 years ago, Northern Natural Gas Company, which does not pass through the state of Wyoming, it passes through Nebraska, proposed a gas quality specification change in their tariff that, by dint of that change, would have made deliveries of gas into Northern Natural by a pipeline that comes out of Wyoming and connects to Northern Natural, would have walled off those deliveries. So here we have a pipeline not in the state, but doing something that would have cost us access to the entire upper Midwest by dint of a tariff change, absent substantial expenditures to change how we treat gas in Wyoming. We argued before the FERC that this change of gas quality specification by this pipeline, not even in Wyoming, made it incongruent with the rest of the pipeline grid and specifically detrimental to Wyoming, and the change requested by the pipeline was rejected with an unusually harsh order.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Director.
Further questions?
That's fascinating stuff. Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Co-chair. Just to expose my ignorance, I understand and I've heard the difference between butane, ethylene, methane, so forth and so on. And that's all separated out in the processing. So the gas that's put in the pipes, that's methane?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burns, it is largely methane. It may have some ethane. Ethane is unusual in that ethane can be sold and extracted from the gas stream and sold as a liquid product where it goes to ethylene plants. Or it can remain a gas and stay in the gas stream and be sold as gas. It carries different values as a liquid or a gas. So whether it is recovered from the gas stream or not changes depending upon the prices of ethane as liquid or gas. Well, all of the above products, propane, butane, are all valuable as pure products.
Well, I haven't even gotten to the ignorant part yet.
Okay.
Methane. Is all methane like methane from the Permian Basin versus methane from over by Pinedale. Is methane all the same BTU content? Is it a constant, unlike oil or coal?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burns, methane is a molecule, one carbon, four hydrogen, CH4. It is chemically the same wherever it comes.
So there's no such thing as light methane, heavy methane, sweet methane, or anything like that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burns, that is absolutely correct.
Okay. Methane is methane.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Any more methane to release around here? All right. Director, I think that's all we have for you. I appreciate your being here, and sorry about the inconveniences on your time because of our time is your time, but...
Mr. Chairman, I fully recognize my day is shorter than yours.
Okay. So, moving right along, next we'll have the Wyoming Infrastructure Authority come on up. Go ahead, introduce yourself.
All right.
Jason, and we'll get underway.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the Joint Appropriations Committee, I'm Jason Bager, the Executive Director of the Wyoming Infrastructure Authority, and I am pleased to provide you with an update of our activities from the past year and a budget overview. With me today is Sarah Young, our Director of Public Affairs and Communications, who joined us in November. Our budget is primarily Series 900, so the best way to understand it is to kind of walk through some of our activities. So first and foremost, the authority works on behalf of the citizens of Wyoming, and it is our job to ensure the state is receiving a return on its investment. Therefore, the economic impacts of our activities is very important to us. In simple terms, we look at what are the activities that have the largest impact to the state's tax base. Thus, the prioritization in 2016 of the Wyoming Integrated Test Center, energy technologies, and coal exports within our strategic plan. This approach attempts to mirror the legislature's investments in these areas. The energy industry has evolved significantly over the past few years, and WIA has had to pivot to remain at the forefront of these issues. While development of new market opportunities for Wyoming resources remains a priority, we've had to be responsive to the critical need of preserving Wyoming's existing markets. The WIA full-time staff consists of two people. We operate under a legislative authority that includes transmission line development, advanced energy technology deployment, and coal export terminal promotion. The WIA is also the managing entity of the new Integrated Test Center. Prior to this fiscal year, WIA utilized an administrative manager as one of the two FTEs. Recognizing the changing needs and current budget situation, we recast that FTE into the professional position that Sarah has. And this assists with our policy issues as also manages our communication efforts. In this day and age where so much of our news is shared via social media, we felt that it was important for WIA to prioritize using these tools to reach our stakeholders' new audiences. Even though WIA is a small operation, there are always opportunities to find savings. I've reviewed all of our contracts, leases, prior year expenditures, and office practices to look for these opportunities, and we've made changes. Last year, I chose to terminate a federal government relations contract that was over 20% of our annual budget. We also moved into new office space, which allows us to host meetings, reducing costs of renting outside space. On top of less expensive rent, the building is home to another state entity, which allows us to tap into an existing IT network, providing additional savings. When looking at many issues facing the energy business development, the opportunities to engage and participate are almost limitless. WIA doesn't have the resources to take the lead on everything. However, we are well positioned to be a part of the state's teams working on various issues and to lead when appropriate. For example, WIA was a lead along with the governor's and attorney general's offices in coordinating the state's reply to the Department of Interior's scoping period for revamping the coal lease process. This effort included representatives from 15 state agencies, resulting in a 74-page document outlining Wyoming's concerns. Collaboration and sharing of resources ensures the state's putting its best foot forward. Just this morning, the BLM released the report and supporting documents totaling 1,378 pages summarizing that scoping process. The BLM received 1,108 unique comments out of over 214,000 total submissions, with 139 of those unique comments specifically attributed to Wyoming. While it will take some time to fully digest the report, all of the suggested alternatives include tax increases in the form of higher royalty rates, plus fees associated with mitigating climate impacts. There is some debate at how quickly a new administration could cancel or change this type of regulatory action, but it will be imperative that Wyoming continues to closely monitor and participate in the process. With such a large number of potential issues, it is important to identify those that are most important and develop a rational implementation plan. In order for any project to proceed, you need three things. First, it needs to be economical or demonstrate a glide path to profitability. Nobody will invest in a money-losing proposition. Secondly, it needs to be feasible. If the technology doesn't exist or if it cannot be permitted, it's not feasible. Lastly, a project needs to be politically viable. Without the support of the community or elected officials, that project will have a very difficult road. Many projects will have varying levels of these elements in the importance of each changes over time. When WIA was created, many projects needed assistance with economics, and that's where our bonding authority came into play. Technological feasibility will always be an issue as society pushes for more efficiencies, but in my opinion, the biggest obstacle we face today comes from politics. We have a federal administration, activist organizations, and some communities opposed to coal. While some will never change their opinion, changing the hearts and minds of those people in the middle of the spectrum will do the most to advance our state's goals. The Integrated Test Center remains our highest priority. When commissioned this fall, Wyoming will have a great example of a private-public partnership that is successful. Beyond the technology that is developed at the facility, the ITC will help change the narrative about coal utilization and how technology can bridge societal concerns about carbon emissions with preserving low-cost, reliable electricity, and thousands of mining jobs. Everyone has seen technology rapidly evolve in our everyday lives. Just look at how cell phones have evolved from suitcases to flip phones to today's iPhones. We need to effectively communicate that those same leaps in technology are occurring in energy. We have also been working to raise the ITC's international profile to ensure that we are attracting the brightest ideas from around the world, but also to learn from what others have done. In November, the ITC was presented to the International CCS Test Center Network, which is comprised of the 10 major carbon research entities from around the world. We are in initial discussions to have the ITC become the 11th member when we become operational. It'll be great to have Wyoming at the table with the major global test centers. There's great interest in Wyoming's approach, and through Governor Meade's leadership, we have seen interest from other potential partners. Montana Governor Steve Bullock placed $3 million in his budget to participate in the ITC, and hopefully the Montana legislature will agree with the importance and appropriate the funds during this year's legislative session. We have also been in discussions with other potential contributors and hopeful we can announce partners in 2017. Over the past year, a significant amount of time has been spent developing the operational structure for the ITC. We have developed a website, the RFP process for soliciting, reviewing, and selecting research teams, a finance structure to take in, hold, and spend money, and acquired necessary insurance information. And between our in-house contract and partners' in-kind contributions, we have a great team of people working on the project. We have also been very active in tracking the development of two coal export terminals in Washington State. SSA Marine's Gateway Pacific Terminal near Bellingham suffered a regulatory setback earlier this year when the Army Corps of Engineers ruled the project would violate the Lummi tribe's historic fishing rights. Currently, the developers of that project are exploring their options, but the nominee to be the new Secretary of Interior, Representative Ryan Zinke from Montana, has been very vocally supportive of this project, and it is possible a new administration could revisit that ruling. On a more positive note, the Millennium Bulk Terminal near Longview, Washington, received its environmental impact statements from the state of Washington in the Army Corps of Engineers in April and September, respectively. Both documents were followed by a comment period, which WIA actively participated in. To push pro-development comments from Wyoming, we created a PR campaign entitled Stay Strong, Wyoming. Our efforts pushed traditional and social media messaging, encouraging people to comment in the process. A website was created to link supporters directly to the comment portal, making the process as simple as possible. Our goal was to help balance the anti-coal comments being pushed by the environmental organizations. While it's impossible to know exactly how many of the individual comments originated in Wyoming, we did receive organizational comments from the Wyoming Mining Association, Wyoming County Commissioners Association, the Wyoming Business Alliance, and the Select Natural Resources Management Committee. Historically, WIA has commissioned and funded a number of studies. However, this past year, we employed a different approach. The actions of the outgoing presidential administration were certainly not friendly to coal-based generation. However, many significant actions are occurring at the state level, and with the new administration, it's almost certain the focus will increase in the states. With every PSC meeting or rate case, anti-coal forces advocate why fossil energy should not be part of the mix. The Energy Policy Network was created by late Wyoming Senator Kelly Mader to provide a pro-coal voice at these state levels. Understanding that the future of Wyoming coal is bleak without customers, WIA made the strategic decision to participate in certain EPN activities in large PRB coal-consuming states such as Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Iowa, Wisconsin, and Michigan. A decline in the domestic use of coal could render Wyoming's investments in R&D useless if the industry were to contract to the point where utilities have no interest in modernizing their coal fleets. We need to preserve Wyoming's coal markets as we continue our investments in technology. WIA believes that the EPN partnership has provided great return on investment for Wyoming. In your handouts is a one-pager outlining the tax revenues saved by Oklahoma Oil and Gas being able to add scrubbers and extend the life of one of their units. That battle was won, ensuring over $8 million in annual tax revenue continues to flow to Wyoming. Also in the handout is using the same tax analysis is the current effort being undertaken in Arkansas. Considering Wyoming's share of federal mineral royalties, coal bonus bids, AML fees, severance and ad valorem taxes, extending the life of these two plants in Arkansas would retain over $31 million annually. And these figures do not include LBA payments. On the transmission front, both the Transwest Express and the Gateway South transmission projects received their records of decisions from the BLM. The Sierra Madre Chokecherry Wind Project, which is tied to the Transwest Express, also received their U.S. Fish Wildlife Service permits, and we expect them to begin construction early this year. All of these projects have been in development for over 8 years, so it's great to see favorable regulatory decisions that also serves as a reminder of the complexity of developing projects on public lands. The WIA is a small entity, but we believe we have had great success over the past year. These are difficult times. However, they provide a great opportunity for Wyoming. We've had our challenges, including our share of budget reductions. However, the energy world will look different in the future, and WIA will continue to utilize our available resources the best we can to ensure the long-term viability of Wyoming's natural resources. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I'd be happy to answer any of your questions.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Lennon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Beggers, I'm just curious about the state education and advocacy expenditures.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about how you went about deciding where those monies were going to go and what that entailed? I think I know, but I just wanted to get your thoughts. So.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Landon, a lot of our budget and the way that we approach things is based on opportunity. You know, what presents itself as the best opportunity to put Wyoming's interests forward. And so a lot of our advocacy expenditures were really based upon what sort of actions were coming down the road. And with it living within our sort of legislative parameters with, you know, energy development, business development, expenditures, and then coal export terminals. And so our board, we sort of looked at this thing holistically. And here we have been charged with, you know, managing the state's $15 million investment in the ITC, plus the $6 million private sector investment, and going, okay, what does this look 5, 10, 15 years down the road? And the great thing about my board is it includes a lot of utility professionals going, the coal industry at a utility level is really at a tipping point. And if we don't do something to help preserve these existing markets, at some point there's this tipping point where a utility could go, we're just going to phase out our coal fleet, and therefore, you know, we're not going to invest in additional technologies moving forward. And so any of these advancements that are coming out of the School of Energy Resources, the ITC, could kind of be for nothing. And so we didn't know exactly what to do, but then when Kelly Mader approached us with this energy policy network, we really felt like that was a great opportunity to sort of push, you know, that pro-coal message in our customer states.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman,
please.
Jason, you and I flew to Seattle and got a firsthand look at some of the pushback that's out there. Mm-hmm. It was almost overwhelming, really. I thought our delegation did a great job in expressing some of the good reasons why we think the industry needs to stay alive and whatever, but boy, are we swimming upstream in some of those areas. I just wonder about your thoughts with regard to, do we still have enough resources in your coffers to get the word out there? Because there comes a point where you just simply can't share the message adequately enough to provide the pushback that we need.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Landon, we're doing our best to operate with the resources that the legislature provides us. There's always more, and sometimes you look back and go, what more could we have done? Over the past year, we kind of almost blew our budget up and started all over and go, okay, where do we really need to focus on? And one great example is how we restructure our FTEs in this additional position, going, okay, do we need a full-time admin? You know, you can kind of use contractors. There's other options there. And would it be better to have somebody in the office who's really focusing on kind of helping us get that message out there? You know, I had a chance with that BLM report that came out this morning. I just kind of glanced through it really quickly and pulled some of those numbers out of there. And if I can go back and pull that out. So they received 214,866 total comments. But of those, only 1,118 were unique. So, you know, you've got 213,000 of them that were just form letters.
Cookie cutters.
Yes. And the report did boil who came out. And over 100,000 of those comments came from the Sierra Club. And so they there's overwhelming support on the other side for what they're doing. But I think being able to come to the table with concrete solutions, my dad has a good saying that pointing out a problem without a solution is called complaining. So, everything that we're doing, it's like, okay, yes, BLM, we're looking at this here, but here's the Wyoming approach. Here's what we think, how we think we can get there. So.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Mr. Kocher.
When we had our opening conference just before on Sunday, before the session started, one of the people that came and spoke to us was Senator Barrasso, who's just been made chairman of the Environment Committee, mm-hmm. So which gave me great hope. And I asked him specifically about the terminals on the West Coast, Washington, and he just sounded very downbeat about it, which made me wonder. Because this is something I've been wondering about all along, whether a state, because of the interstate commerce clauses and pacts, can a state just decide we're not going to ship a particular product? And if they can do that, then why couldn't they do it with, let's say, Montana wheat that competes with Washington wheat, or Wyoming or Montana wood that compete, or Canadian mm-hmm. wood that meet that competes with Washington wood. So I'm trying to figure out where they have the authority to determine that, you know, we're just not going to ship this product because we don't like it.
Mr. Chairman, what I've seen in a lot of the states, state of Washington's comments and responses to these various port projects is they're trying to find environmental grounds. We kind of see through that, you know, that smoke screen, what they're really trying to do. But to the two different project developers' credits, they have gone above and beyond in the regulatory reviews, the environmental studies, the cleanup efforts, those sort of things to try to really take the environmental reasons to say no to the project off the table. I think what's fair to say is this is going to end up in the courts. If, for example, the project in Longview does receive their permit, and they're expected to receive a record of decision by June or July of this year. If it does go favorably, and it does look like they have to approve it just because They have crossed every T, dotted every I. They're like, give a reason to say no. We fully expect the Sierra Club and the other side to come back and litigate. If for whatever reason it is denied, I would expect the project developers to file some sort of lawsuit to say, we've done everything that you've said you've done, you know. So I do think there's going to be litigation before this is all said and done.
And the only other point that I don't quite understand is it the Lummi Indians?
Yes.
Supposedly affecting their fishing, traditional fishing area or something.
The Lummi.
I don't know that that's part of their reservation or not, but I don't quite understand why their rights are more important than the Crow Indian rights.
Mr. Chairman, that is an additional interesting piece of case law that is yet to be sort of determined in the courts, is how one tribe can supersede another tribe. But what's really interesting about that Cherry Point location is that area right off the coast of the Puget Sound was designated in the early 80s as an industrial zone by Whatcom County. And along that zone, they developed a BP refinery. Then there was this space for future development, and then it was an Alcoa smelter, and I believe it's a ConocoPhillips refinery. So this project, this coal export terminal, would be sandwiched right in between the BP refinery and the Alcoa smelter. And so what is really interesting, and I think it's one of the issues that the developers are looking at litigating, is saying, so this little slice of water here that we're looking to pull boats in, that is the most historical fishing area in the world. But this refinery over here and this smelter over here, you know, really, you know, you don't fish over there. So the developers do feel like they do have a strong case moving forward, but, you know, they're looking at that. And if you do go out and look at the site and you stand on the water, you look to your right, you look to your left, and you go, this looks like a pretty good spot for an export terminal.
So. Mr. Chairman, just to pick up on the co-chairman's thoughts, when we were out there to testify in front of the BLM, we heard on pretty good authority that there are a lot of the Indian tribe folks who were there to protest had been paid to be there. And the resources that some of these groups have, it's just startling. I mean, it's really almost overwhelming. So I think it's important that we stay diligent.
Representative Burkhardt.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Jason, we have your annual report, and that's, mm-hmm. It's very nice, very interesting reading, and thank you. However, could you do one thing for us? Would you please update your budget narrative?
Sure.
There are dates in there that go back to 2012 as being projected, and we're a little out of date, please.
Okay.
Thank you.
Further questions? All right. I think that's well done, Jason. Good to see you again. With that, I think we'll just keep rolling so we can move on. Let's go to fire prevention, electrical safety.
Thanks, Jason.
Thank you, Marshal Reed. Could you please introduce yourself? And
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Mike Reed, the current Wyoming State Fire Marshal and Director of the Department of Fire Prevention and Electrical Safety. I've brought with me a full two-thirds of our administration. In the back, we have Deputy Fire Marshal Mark Young. We have the state chief electrician, John Vostert. And next to me is the entire finance department for the department, Justine Morris.
You've lost your Fremont County connection, though.
We still have the academy there with a number of people. if you would, I did not prepare remarks at this stage, but would open with a couple of unprepared remarks, if that would be all right.
That would be fine, and we're giving Jason a little bit of leeway because he's still a little new green there to do his opening remarks. We'll save that for the budget session.
Thank you. I told my wife last night that I think I started in the wrong year for the division, but it's been exciting so far. Thank you, sir. To start off the the new director for the division, it has been a remarkable educational experience for me to learn the duties of the State Fire Marshal's Office or the Fire Prevention and Electrical Safety Office. And not only are we involved in directly in fire prevention and electrical safety, but we also do plan reviews, permitting, electrical licensing for all electricians operating within the state of Wyoming, and that includes electricians from outside of the state who wish to work in our state. By statute, we are required to implement fire safety programs designed to minimize fire hazards and disasters, loss of life, establishment and enforcement of fire safety and safety practices throughout the state, preventative inspections and corrective activities on different facilities around the state, including all state facilities, and then facilities within jurisdictions that don't have the ability to perform their own inspections. We have coordination of fire safety programs, critical analysis and evaluation of fire loss statistics, and then the coordination and development and implementation of training programs to designed to assist firefighters in all phases of fire prevention. As of 2007, I believe the division actually assumed the oversight of the Fire Academy in Riverton, and we oversee a number of conferences and training for fire services across the state. With that, I would stand for any questions concerning our budget and the supplemental budgets that we've put forward, and I'll answer any questions you may have.
Why don't you just walk through each division, and for things where there's only the enterprise changes, you can kind of just briefly touch on them, and we'll just kind of go through each one real quickly.
All right, and you'll notice with my newness that I'll look at Justine pretty frequently and ask her. I guess I would start with our supplemental budget. We had a total reduction of $202,996. That was accomplished by some movement of positions, electrical inspection positions, from the general fund into our special fund, which it takes in the special fund. I may need to mention that is supplied by the permitting fees and the electrical licensing fees that we receive from those services, and so it doesn't directly affect the general fund. We've also taken other steps across our budget to try to reduce not only the number of positions that we have in the Fire Marshal's Office, but the number of offices that we have. Through a retirement, we reduced one of our electrical inspection positions in Afton, and we closed that office. Now, that's not reflected, of course, in our budget, but it does directly affect the budget for A&I. So you'll see a reduction for that office and all the associated costs in their budget. The way we did that was we reached an agreement with an inspector out of Green River who assumed the role and the duties of the Afton office, and so she assured us that she thought she could do the travel and assume that role. And so we've done those types of things across the board in our office in hope of meeting some of the requirements of the current financial state in Wyoming. just to continue on, as an example for you, the fire marshal's office has gone through a series of reductions of personnel over the last, let's say, 10 years. I believe in 2007, the office had 35 employees and then assumed the management of the fire academy, which brought us to a total of 39 employees. At this stage, or at this time, through the reductions over the last 10 years, our office has a total of 32 positions on our budget. So it's a reduction of 7 positions over the last 10 years. And so with that, we're actually trying to put positions together. Recently, we combined an admin position with an inventory position, I guess, and then we combined our human resource person with another admin position to help accomplish that. I don't know if there's any questions over that section or not.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Burkhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Reed, question. Yes. I'm on page 8 of your budget.
Yes, sir.
Item 0292, bottom of the 200 series, maintenance contracts external. Close to $600,000. And I'd just like to know what those are.
Representative Burkhardt, that is for our database for the Sapphires program, but there was a calculation error because we had $363,707 that we got authority from you guys in the last session. And it got put into this unit, but it was supposed to go into the special revenue unit, 0880305. There is only $215,900 in that budget, in that line item, and that is used for our database.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Kocher.
While we're on page 8, up in employer health insurance benefits, there's a reduction of $11,000 and change. Was that the rate holiday you got?
Yes, sir.
So basically that cut is not really sustainable because it was a one-time rate holiday.
Correct.
So what are we going to do on an ongoing basis of that then?
That.
Plus the fact it doubles. So it's, so we're actually talking, it's going to be about a $23,000 shortage.
Senator Burns, there was a total cut for our whole department, $151,585. And that came from the holiday rate for the insurance that did not have to pay.
The rate holiday consisted of three things. Actually, there was a rate holiday. And there's a stable rate. We believe that we can maintain that stable rate because of the fact of the high cash balance that we had. And also the Converse County situation with the housing allowance. Those three things incorporate that across the enterprise. I don't believe that they have a Converse County issue on their side.
No.
No employees there. So it's not going to double. I mean, what we took was $11,486 from their standard budget. And that's out of their standard budget now. Now, the future will be predicated on the actual cost of the plan. So as we move into the future, for example, this last fiscal year, 2016, we actually spent less dollars in a medical benefit plan for EGI than we did in the previous year. Naturally, as we go into the future, it's all going to be predicated on what the costs are associated with the EGI benefit plan. But right now, their standard budget has been reduced by that $11,486.
Because we had a light year in terms of sick illnesses and sicknesses and so forth.
A combination of several different things. In 2014, we started the process with this committee to have actuarial information come to us on our plan and our plan participants so that we have a better understanding of what our costs would be and how we budget for EGI's costs. And in that process, one of the things that we did was is we asked him, well, what is a reasonable, secure cash reserve in that plant? And we were trying to move to that lower cash balance. And then we were fortunate enough in 2016 to actually have fewer dollars spent on the plan than we did in the prior year. So that led to the one-month rate holiday, and then the fact that we have now established a stable rate. We don't have an intention for that rate increase in this coming fall. We didn't have one last fall. And then as we progress in the future, we'll continue to use that actuarialist to have give us information on what we need to have as far as the plan needed.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I understand what you're saying, that this rate was actuarially arrived at, and therefore it is sustainable.
There's a risk with me saying that this is going to be stable forever. I don't think that that's going to be true. I mean, there's going to be fluctuations in the cost provided in the plan. There's a couple other small things that happened. The deductibles were increased a little bit. That's going to help us out in the cash balance as we progress into the 17 and 18 and beyond. But I do believe eventually you could expect that it's going to cost us more to provide medical care at the same level that we do today, eventually. But right now and, you know, in the next few years, we expect to see that the cash balance that we have and the rate that we have in place currently will be stable for a little while.
Thank you.
Representative Schwartz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to go back to that line 292 about where there was the mistake. And my question is, if there was a mistake there, shouldn't that show up other places in the budget?
Representative, yes, it did. It shows up back on page. We had to do what was called B11 to decrease this authority in this division to give the authority into the 088, 0305. And that's on page. I don't know if it would show up on this report until. Because we did this. We just did this not too long ago. Because we got the authority to spend on it. Hold on, let me find it.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I can help out a little bit.
Thank you.
Originally, we had that total amount of that money budgeted for out of general funds. And then what we did was we picked up, you'll see on the bottom of page 8, we picked up a large portion of that out of the electrical services fees that they get. So in that case, when we had the budget delivered last year, we had this conversation that they are now picking up a much larger share of that cost with their electrical service fees rather than have it totally generally funded.
Representative Summers.
So, Mr. Chairman, am I under the assumption then that the only reductions in this whole budget is the governor's enterprise reductions? Is that correct in all of these divisions or? Or at least go. If not, I need to, because I'm new to this. I need you to go through each division and tell me what you cut, because otherwise I can't figure it out. That was my assumption.
Representative Summers, on the supplemental cut, we only did it in one division, and we took a whole position and a 10% of another position, and we moved it from in the 100 series. In the amount of $202,996. We moved it from unit 0301 into the special revenue fund of 088-0305. That was just on the supplemental part of it. We've had the penny plan cut, and we did the global cut, but prior to this, and then we had the supplemental cut that we're speaking about on the supplemental. And that only affected one division.
Mr. Chairman? I think there's two questions that are being discussed currently. We just addressed the fact that they picked up a larger share of those costs with their special revenue. Then the question was asked about, is this the only cut that you have for the agency? That's not the case. The $11,486 is only for the unit that they've discussed so far. They have several more that they'll go through here as we proceed.
We're on page 3.
on page 8 is where I'm looking at the first unit that they're having a conversation about, 0101. There's several more units that they'll walk you through with the remainder of the budget cuts that they have for the supplemental.
Okay. Let's get there.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. On page 10, this is Division 200. That's our fire prevention. The $50,241 that you see cut there, that was the holiday rate that was cut in that division. And then,
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Representative Burkhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm on page 10.
Okay.
And looking at the $50,241 cut reduction in 0201.
Yes.
Okay. If you go over to page 13, it shows that cut coming out of the 100 series. Is that
correct?
Just an error?
No, that the rate holiday, that's insurance, and that comes out of the 100 series, out of 0105 line item, because that's your benefits, because insurance
correct.
Is considered benefits.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I don't understand the 0201 then on page 10.
That 0201, that is a unit for fire prevention, because we have 5 units in our department.
All right.
Late in the day.
Okay.
That's okay.
Keep going.
Okay. On page 14, let me go further to give you that. We had, on page 17 in unit 0301, that's our electrical safety, we had a reduction of $252,547. Of that, the 202,996 that went from, we credited the general fund of that amount, and that was taken, switched to the enterprise special fund, and then the remainder of that is the employee great holiday.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could just back up page 11 with the plan review fees.
Okay.
I'm just wondering, because I've been doing some page 11, although there's another revenue area as well, so the question might be the same. But were you talking about the plan review fees?
Yes.
Now, two parts. One, it says at the top it's to ensure public buildings. So is this only for – I mean, this is not for houses as well. This is just for public buildings. That's one question. And the other one is, because I've noticed that the health department fees, some fees haven't been changed in, like, decades. What kind of fee is normally charged to, say, an average project, and when's the last time you raised your fee?
I will have to turn that over to
Mr. Chairman.
Absolutely.
Representative Wilson, I would ask Deputy Fire Marshal Mark Young to address that. And we actually had a discussion about the fee structure for the Fire Marshal's office recently. And it has been many, many years since there was an increase in the fee structure. The question about public buildings, I can answer that. Public buildings would include any buildings where the public frequents them. Houses are not included in our plan review requirements. And some states do require that, but the state of Wyoming does not require plan reviews on residential structures. Deputy Fire Marshal, would you like to add anything to that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson.
There's a just 1 second. We won't want to get a microphone in your hands just because we're broadcast live, and if we're
I don't know how to work it.
How's this work?
And it takes two buttons, I believe, to make that.
Press the left one until it turns green.
Thank you.
There we go. All right. First time we've got it right today so far. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson. In regards to your query about fees and when they've been raised, it's my understanding I've been here since 2013, and they obviously haven't been raised since then. Our fees are based in what was based off of the International Building Codes in 1998, and we do not and have not we haven't had any rate fees or fee increases since that period of time. So it's been many years since we've increased those fees. I don't have an average plan review fee for you, but let's say a University of Wyoming project that there's fees for, if we were to collect those, which we don't, would be somewhere in maybe $10,000 to $20,000 for an average building.
Please proceed. So it says it's you don't charge for plan reviews for other state agencies, so you only charge for plan reviews to, like, county buildings or federal buildings or something like that? I mean, is that or like public restaurants maybe? Or I mean, is that who's paying for you?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, that is correct. And speaking in real general terms, we'll do everything that's not state-owned and that we charge fees to restaurants, bars, hotels, motels, restaurants, you know, those types of public occupancies are what we do charge fees for. And then it's also important to know, Mr. Chairman, that we that 100% of the fees we collect on plan reviews go directly into the general fund.
Mr. Co-Chair.
I'm sorry, two questions. Your inspectors, you only deal with smaller towns and non-incorporated areas. Do the larger cities, they have their own inspection regimes or not?
Many, Mr. Chairman, Senator Burns, many of the communities, larger communities, do have their own inspectors, and they would have the option of claiming home rule. And so if a community has claimed home rule, then we do not do the inspections there.
And so your office picks up everybody else?
Anyone that does not claim home rule. That would be correct, sir.
How many cities claim home rule?
Oh.
Can you know right off the bat, like six of them or so?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have the number right in front of me. We can certainly get that, but I do know that our Class A cities are Casper, Cheyennes, Sheridan, Rock Springs. Those cities and towns have taken local jurisdiction, and they have their own staffs. They have requested that jurisdiction, as by statute, through us, based upon qualifications of inspectors. We have granted that jurisdiction to them, and so they perform that. And then there are a handful of counties, such as Laramie County, Natrona County, as well a bit of Uinta County, that has also their own
a
local
bit.
Jurisdiction. Well, it's carved up a little.
Oh, okay. And one other question, Mr. Chairman. And I hate to drag you back, but going back to page 5, this is the administration for fire prevention, electrical safety. What is that 200 series supportive services? That's $668,000.
That's a total of all of our line items, to utilities all the way down to the maintenance contracts, internal, external.
So that dollar figure runs through the entire division?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. That's what I was confused about.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Foxton.
As we close out here, I just like to say it's probably important we all partake in these budget cuts. The director acknowledged the closure of the Afton office, and full disclosure, I was the landlord of that Afton office. So I'd like to say, if you need a question, isn't it great that we can all take part in these budget cuts?
Representative Walters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Young.
So the rents just got reasonable.
I'm sorry, Senator Chairman.
Just now got reasonable.
I'm actually a little concerned about my position suddenly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Young, on page, you were discussing, we're on page 15, you were discussing the revenue generated, and you said it all goes to the general fund, and on page 15 it shows it's a 60-40 split with 40 to the general fund, 60 to the operational side of this, this unit. Could you clarify or tell me more?
Yeah. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, Representative Walters, there are two separate types of fees that are generated within our agency. One is plan review fees, and the other one is lumped of electrical licensing fees and permitting fees. So when we talk about licensing fees and permitting fees, and that's for electrical only, that's the 60-40 split. So we receive 60%, and that's the special revenue fund that we have been referencing, and 40% of that those dollars goes to the general fund. Plan review fees, 100% goes to the general fund.
Please proceed.
Proceeding on page 24, that would be our training division, unit 0401. There was the cut of $32,382, and that's including, that's the rate holiday. And then in our 500 division, that's the fire academy. And again, the cut was the rate holiday of $8,025. So the really between the rate holiday and then the supplemental of the 202,000, that's one division was really affected, was our electrical division, where it came out of the 100 series into the 100 series in the special revenue fund.
Okay. Anything else?
That's it.
Any further questions? Going once, going twice. All right, I think that will do it.
All righty, thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to take a really quick break. I think that President Bebout wanted to have a chat before we go on to the next agency. Do you know if I just saw him in and out? You want to see if he's out there? We'll proceed. Looks like he's...
Oh, there we go.
Thank you, sir.
Good description, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'm Steve True, the director of the Livestock Board.
With me today is Ann Enright, our accounting analyst. We'd like to thank you and your committee for the opportunity to visit about our budget for this year. With your permission, sir, I'd like to, since you have some new members, I'd like to give a very brief synopsis of the Livestock Board and their statutory function. We are there to exercise general supervision over the livestock interests of the state from theft and disease. By statute, we do that through four units, our animal health unit, headed by the state veterinarian's office. We have a brand inspection and recording unit and law enforcement that protects the industry from theft and deals with livestock ownership identification and an administration unit that offers administrative duties to the field forces of the agency. And I'd like to share with the committee at this time that since the submittal of the governor's recommended budget for 2017-18 through the global cuts, penny plan, austerity cuts, the governor's recommended 8% cut in the enterprise reductions, the Livestock Board has enacted a little over $1.5 million in cuts, or 18% of our general fund budget to this point. With your permission, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to take you to our first cut on page 8. This cut, sir, is to our administration unit. It's agency reduction priority number 7. Total unit reduction is $4,000. From the 100 series, we've deducted $1,000 of board member payroll. From our 200 series in admin, we deducted $1,500 from director's travel budget. And from the 900 series, $1,500 in professional services. If there's no questions there, Mr. Chairman, our next page is page 11 in our supplemental budget book. This is a cut from unit 103, which is our information technology general fund portion, and we have reduced $1,500 there. If there are no questions there, our next page to go to, Mr. Chairman, would be page 15. This is unit 201, animal health. Our agent reduction priority number 6 of $20,000 here from professional services. I would note that at the time we took this cut, or we lost one full-time position in the austerity cuts in the budget session in the last budget bill, Mr. Chairman, from that unit.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Larson.
Thank you. Mr. True, could you just share with me what kind of professional services that included?
That includes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, that would include professional printing of educational forms, informatory, informational forms, regulatory forms, our health certificate books, that sort of item. Mr. Chairman, our next cut would be on page 18 of our supplemental budget book to our law enforcement unit. We have taken a $15,000 reduction in the 200 series there. Mr. Chairman, we have kept back a pickup rather that was due for changeover through motor pool to get a new pickup. We kept the old pickup there to reduce those charges. Maintains us one extra vehicle for law enforcement in the case of a breakdown or something, so that we have a vehicle suited in with all the radios and equipment necessary. Our next cut, Mr. Chairman.
Co-chair.
Can I go back to page 16, please? And this is your animal health. I was curious about your communication expense, $13,400. Did you have to get a new piece of equipment or pieces of equipment?
Mr. Chairman, I would defer that question to my accounting analyst.
My name's Anna Enright. I'm the accounting analyst at the Wyoming Livestock Board. Mr. Chairman, Senator, the communications actually covers postage and it covers shipping. We send out a lot of tags, the RFID tags, trichomoniasis tags, although the heading is communication, it actually covers postage, shipping, and those kind of communications as well.
Okay. Is that a Casper accent?
Kansas.
South Casper.
Representative Summers.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Director, maybe go over what, on your animal health, what your three employees are and what they do.
Our three general fund employees in animal health. Thank you, Mr. Representative Summers. Mr. Chairman, those are our field veterinarian, who is in charge of doing most of the bleeding on brucellosis testing, all of the field work, does a lot of contacting with feedlots as far as permitting and with your local veterinarians. And there are the two animal health technicians in our office that offer the health permits, answer questions, and take care of all of the bookwork and logistical work for that animal health department. Mr. Chairman, if there's no questions, I think we were going to page 22.
Mr. Chairman. I'll stay on 16 for just a bit. I see you got five, back to the same line as Representative Summers, five employees in the law enforcement. Can you tell me what you've got and where they're located at and what part of their deal is theft and just a general of what they do?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Driscoll, there are five positions in the law enforcement division. There are four full-time and one part-time AWAC position, which is not occupied currently. I have a senior investigator based in Pinedale. I have an investigator based here in Cheyenne, one in Sheridan, and one in Riverton. We have the four districts in the state. Of their time, I don't have those reports with me to give you an actual percentage of their time on theft versus welfare versus other duties, but I would be happy to get that to you. Okay, Mr. Chairman, now I'll take a shot at page 22. That's under brucellosis travel, and we've reduced that expenditure by $496. There are no questions there. Page 24 would be the next cut, which is under brucellosis testing. Mr. Chairman, we've reduced that by $70,000, $20,000 to in-state travel, $50,000 to farm and livestock supplies. There are no questions there. Our next.
President Summers.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. So slow down a bit. $20,000 on... Mr. Chairman, so $20,000 on in-state travel, and the $50,000 is exactly what?
Farm and livestock supply. Mr. Chairman, Representative Summers, farm and livestock supplies can cover everything from panels, leasing of panels, or renting of panels, or a generator for testing, remote testing, or any supply necessary in the realm of the vets doing their testing or quarantine proper actions.
Representative Schwartz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So what constitutes a serious brucellosis outbreak?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schwartz, a positive test.
One. Thank you.
Please proceed.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, we are now at page 27 of our budget book, the Astray Unit. We have reduced that unit by $5,000 to our professional services part of Astray's.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Driscoll.
It's true. On the Astray Fund for $50,000, is that spent for care and whatnot? And what do we do with unclaimed Astray money? Does it go back to where if someone never shows up? What's the time frame and where does it go?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Driscoll, if an animal is sold in the Astray and that money goes unclaimed, it's for a year from the date of the sale, which could carry that to the second year. That money would then be placed in our inspection account if there has been no claim proof of ownership provided on that animal.
Mr. Chairman, where do we spend the rest of the 45 other thousand, and where is it going to? Are these impounded animals somewhere you've got?
Mr. Chairman, these can be costs as far as from veterinary costs to cost of care. If those animals are placed in a sale barn or an outside facility, will there be a cost of care provided there, or our own cost of care at our facility? Also could be farrier services on stray horses that need their feet cleaned up. It could be any type of improving of that animal's welfare. Those costs can come under that stray account.
Could we bill these back to the owner? I mean, someone owns these animals, and at some point either they're sold or they retrieve them. Can they be billed back for these services?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Driscoll, if we were to have picked up one of your animals as an stray and you proved up on ownership, you would have to pay those costs of care to reclaim that money. It would come out of there.
Mr. Chairman, so we're losing $45,000 a year. Why isn't that account staying full if that's the case? Either the animal sold or someone brings them back, but it seems like that account should not have a cost.
Mr. Chairman, as to the physics of that account, I might defer part of this to Ms. Enright, but I would say that that account goes up and down. We get restitution payments to that account sometimes, and we pay these costs out. And then we may get restitution on the example I gave you, and so that account balance can fluctuate. We don't just pay out the $45,000. If there's a balance left over, sir, and Ms. Enright will correct me if I'm wrong here, that would be reverted, and then that fund will be reappropriated again the next time. If we have $40,000 left over, that $40,000 will revert, and then we will be reappropriated that.
Mr. Chairman, so we're supplementing your other budget basically by reverting every year. That's what we're doing. Because it should be self-canceling over time. If money comes in, money goes out, should be neutral to the budget. And obviously it's not. We're putting $50,000 a year every year. I'm wasting a lot of time on not very much money, but it just seems like it ought to either pay itself back off or it just shouldn't be there.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Summers.
Mr. Chairman, does this account include your welfare cases?
Not generally, but occasionally. Mr. Chairman and Representative Summers, it can, is how I should answer that. It depends on whether this is an stray animal at a sale barn, or it could be a welfare case that winds up being sold as an stray. In that case, then, this account would be active in that case.
And then follow up, Mr. Chair.
Uh-huh.
So in that case, there would be no restitution, because if it's a welfare case and it's in a stray, likely you're not going to get any. You
true.
Might not get any money out of the.
Yes, true.
Out of the deal.
Please proceed,
Mr. Chairman. Our final page entry is on page 34. This is in Unit 701, our general fund contribution to brand inspection. We have reduced this unit by $558,936 in order to comply with the governor's 8% recommended cut.
Questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is not about this particular page. If there's someone with a question that wants, I run ahead on brand inspection. But my question actually is going back to page 3. You said that over the course of the various cuts that your department had cut 1-point-something million. But I'm a little confused because I see the revised appropriation for total 18.3 million, and when I look back on the 15-16 budget, that was 18 million and a little bit more. But so I guess I lost your $1 million. Could you just find that for me, please?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, what you'll find there on the other funds line, where our revenue fund has replaced that $558,000 cut that I just told you came from general fund. Those are costs that have to be paid And so our fee-based account will pay those costs, so the revised budget stays neutral on that number. And there was also in the budget session last year, thank you to the Appropriations Committee for granting us the spending authority of $736,000 for raises to the brand inspectors. And in an attempt to be fiscally conservative, we only used half of that and have maintained the rest in there. But that $736,000 increase in our budget is included as well, the spending authority, which comes from a fee-based account and not from general fund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 35, 36, right in there, as we're talking about brand inspectors, and you're cutting $558,000 out of that. Just a little more description on how that will affect the entire brand inspection program, number of inspectors in the field, all of that, producer increases in producer fees. We kind of rushed over the whole thing, and so just a little more description in that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walters, at this time it does not affect our brand inspector force for the state. If I might digress momentarily, those inspectors are placed geographically in the state to be able to serve the producers when and where they need it in order to do their commerce at the time and place they need to. And I'm not sure how to answer. I guess I would need you to do clarify your question on the fee increases for me, so I know exactly what you would like me to, how you'd like me to reply to that.
Following up then, it shows where we as a legislature appropriated general funds to allow for pay increases to these brand inspectors, and if we deduct $558,000 from this, there will be a pay decrease, I would guess, or to maintain that level of pay, is that going to come from increasing the fees for brand inspection, or how do you plan to make up for this lost revenue that appears to be allocated already towards pay increases?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walters, Just to be clear, that pay increase is paid not from general fund, but from our revenue-based account. Our revenues, our brand inspection recording revenues, are gave the pay increases to the inspectors. That was not a general fund a dollar at all. Where I referred to the general fund is we cut $558,900 from our general fund appropriation from brand inspection, but those costs, we carried those costs over from the revenue fund will make that up. The revenue fund is making that up, and where that affects that fund is in its pay down, and going forward. The original statutory blend was 65% revenue, or revenue-based account, 35% general fund. When we made the agreement with the pay raises, that changed to 70-30. Following all the cuts I listed earlier, that's increased a little more, but we still would pencil at the 70-30 level. So those raises are still being made up from the revenues that the producers pay. It's not from general fund. And that's the reason why we only took half of the spending authority granted by the legislature last year in order to be conservative with that spending authority.
Mr. Chairman.
Director
Drew, can you go a little bit more into the changes in the exempt status? I know a little about it, but what do we have coming down the road at us as these inspectors are no longer able to be, I don't know how to classify them, but I understand that they're going to change in the near future, and it's going to have a huge change on how we compensate and how their health insurance works. Can you explain kind of what's going on and what we can expect coming at us in the legislature for cost changes?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Driscoll, please, Mr. Chairman, yank me back if I start to go into the weeds on this one. That is a Department of Labor rule that the state employees are subservient to, and our inspectors were deemed to be non-exempt from overtime now rather than exempt as they have been in the past. That we are currently under contract on that basis. We signed a one-year contract at the end of the fiscal year last year on the proviso to review how that contract is working going forward rather than go on a biennial basis as our inspectors have historically been contracted. I guess today to tell you the time, the compensation policy, let me back up one step. The compensation policy in the state says that a state employee can either take comp time or overtime. So if a person has comp time left at the end of that period, it has to be paid out. Our period has been adjusted by HRD to the end of the fiscal year rather than December 31st, as most employees in the state would be. So as of about a week ago, the overtime or comp time that's been built up, our liability could be on July 1 at $50,000. It could be higher than that by the time that it rolls around. Could be less if brand inspectors have used comp time.
Thank you.
But good, that's number. Our dollar basis as of a little bit ago.
Mr. Crutcher?
Are you talking about the regulation coming down from the U.S. Department of Labor?
Yes, sir.
I thought the court had overturned that rule.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burns, there's an injunction against the rule going forward. Doesn't matter to us. Our contract was done last year on the basis that it, here it came. So we contracted for a year on that.
Okay.
Pending what happens in the administration, that would be something that our Ag Committee and the government could look at going forward. But right now we're under contract on the basis that it would be rule.
Okay. The other question I have is you've got 116 employees, 97 are AWAC. How many of those are brand inspectors?
We have one AWAC person in the brucellosis at the Riverton office. The rest are brand inspectors, 60 full-time, and then the rest are part-time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. So, you know, in the event that this committee were to look at the general fund dollars, you know, because the agencies come, and so I'm asking this question, but so in the event that we were to look at the general fund dollars based upon this agency coming into the general fund kind of relatively late, and I asked you this question earlier in private, how would you and could you handle going if all brand inspectors were to revert back to brand inspection fees? So no general fund dollars. So how would the agency handle it and could it handle it under your current fee structure? Because you can only raise, this is going from memory from some years ago, but it seems like you could only raise fees 20% a year. And I don't remember if there's a cap on that. And so that's my question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Summers, if you don't mind, I'm going to feed your question back to you to make sure I answer the right one. What would our fee structure need to be if there was no general fund to the brand inspection unit?
Yes.
Part A to the question is yes, by statute now our board can raise fees up to 20% one time per year through the rulemaking process. Given the variables of inspection numbers due to weather, forage ability, markets, interest rates, it's hard to project brand inspection numbers. If our recording numbers are a little easier to project, the number would probably be in excess of a 50% fee increase to replace that general fund. I would like to supply the caveat that we are also by statute supposed to keep a 1-year operating reserve of the fee-based account. If there was no longer a general fund, that would increase the amount of operating reserve we would be required to hold. I think we would run into trouble with that part of the statute, Mr. Chairman, at the end of the next biennium, for certain, even with a 50% fee increase.
Quickly, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Currently, and I can't even remember, what's our brand inspection fees?
Cattle are $1.50 a head. That'd go to $2.25. Sheep would go from 30 to 45 cents. A lifetime horse inspection would go from $18 to $27. Renewal for your brand would go from $300 to $450.
Thank you. Further questions? Okay. And anything else?
Mr. Chairman, not from
this
seat.
That's the end of the show. Okay. Well, we appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank
you for waiting around.
Thank you, committee members. We appreciate the chance to talk about it.
So we've got one left. Should we plow on through?
Yeah.
Keep going. Why are we paving on the first one?
Well, that's not good. Broken.
Chair? Switch?
No, no. Trying to make it go up. I'm not doing a very good job of it.
Okay. Welcome. Glad to have you here. Please, Director Carpenter, is that correct?
Chairman Fitzsimmons. This
Fitzsimmons.
Is Director Carpenter.
Oh, no. Yeah, there we go. Okay.
Chairman Nichols, thank you.
Let me know. Introduce ourselves and let's move forward.
Will do. Thank you. Chairman Nichols, Co-Chair Burns, committee members. My name is Tom Fitzsimmons. I'm the chairman of the Enhanced Oil Recovery Commission. With me today is Stephen Carpenter, our director, and Rob Herless, our associate director, assistant director, deputy director. I'm sorry, Rob.
We know that guy.
We're glad to have him. We had a rather extended presentation today, but given the day and where we're at, we've really shortened it to 6 slides. And if you could, it's in your budget book. We'll be going off of that. We're here today to really just review our supplemental budget. Steve will do most of that work. For the new members of this committee, I just wanted to give you an update as to who the Enhanced Oil Recovery Commission is, what we do, and where we're at in terms of our budget requests. The Enhanced Oil Recovery Commission was formed in 2004 by statute, and the intent was to develop technology and transfer that technology to Wyoming fields so we could improve recovery. Some of the results of our work over the last 10 years includes work with Devon Energy at Big Sand Draw and Wirtz Field, as well as identifying a number of other candidate fields for enhanced oil recovery. The process of enhanced oil recovery is a very long-term process. The technology gets developed. You train the companies as to how it can be implemented, and once they have the capital plan in place and the oil prices are right, the project gets implemented. These are long-term investments, and we appreciate the investment that legislature has given this commission. In our budget review, as a highlight, I will share with you that we've taken all cuts that have been asked of us by the governor's office as well as legislature. In addition to that, our commission mandated that Steve take a relook at his budget, and we took an additional 3% budget cut off of that, and we'll go through that. Our focus has changed in the last 18 months. In January of 2015, we made the conscious decision to improve our outreach to industry so that technology actually touched Wyoming fields and Wyoming operators. In order for us to do that, much of our expenditures that we had focused on academic research, we shifted, and we shifted that to outreach. And we partnered closer with the School of Energy Resources and Mark Northam, and that's been a great relationship. So rather than having two entities, SER and Enhanced Oil Recovery Commission, sponsoring research projects, we put that work directly on Mark's hands, and we focused on application. How can we get this technology out to the fields? In July of 2015, we relocated most of our staff to Casper, to the Wyoming Technology Business Center in Casper, right next to the Wyoming Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. And in doing so, we had feedback from industry immediately that the technology transfer and the availability of moving the data and the information from Laramie to the industry in Casper was happening. It wasn't happening before that because we didn't have a presence where industry was. And so that's been a remarkable change for us and very positive feedback, and we look forward to the results of that in the years to come. I would ask that you turn to, on your budget slide presentation, slide 4, and this is where Steve will speak to our supplementary budget and then take any questions that you might have.
I'm sorry, presentation? Is this in our
packet? It's in your budget book, I believe.
It's in our budget book.
No, not in your book. It's separate.
Slide 4.
I'm sorry, Co-Chair Burns. It's also page, I believe it's page 3 of our supplementary budget, if that's what you have open. Page 4 of our presentation.
So it's page 3 of the budget?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, if I may, it is page 3 of your of our supplemental budget. I have, if you have your handouts, there's only 6 slides. I'd like to direct your attention to those. On slide number 4 of your handout is a copy of page 3 of your supplemental budget. If I could take you there, it will be, I think, easier for our discussion. As you can see, we have 2 lines, line 100, which is commission and support, and line 200, which is technical outreach and research. Our budgets on those 2 respective lines, we took 2 reductions, $49,363 and $498,967, respectively, out of those 2 lines. Based on the discussions that were had earlier today by other agencies, it's not listed here, but I will share with you the first line item 100 of those $49,000 cuts. $40,000 were cuts made by our agency. $8,967 were enterprise cuts. And on line 200, the $498,000 line, $440,000 of those were agency cuts and $58,978 were enterprise cuts. If I could draw your attention to slide number 5 in your handout, that shows our budget breakdown by category. We have 5 major categories that include salary, projects, operating expenses, outreach, and commission meetings. You can see that the percentages of those budgets and how they relate to our overall general fund. Our general fund total is $5.565 million for the biennium. We do have a non-general fund line of just under $90,000, which represents about 1.6% of our budget. That outside hard dollars come primarily from sponsorship, directly from industry, used for our conferences, workshops, and outreach. What's significant, but not necessarily shown here, are the in-kind contributions. In order for us to do project work, operators have to invest and have in-kind or cost share. In the calendar year 2016, Wyoming operators invested just under $500,000 with us to implement projects in the field in Wyoming. If I could draw your attention to slide number 6 of the packet. Yeah. Co-Chair Burns, just trying to read your body language. You have the packet, and am I able to get you?
I was confused, but I finally found it.
I apologize. On slide 6 is a simple narrative of where reductions came from. As the EORC chairman, Fitzsimmons, indicated, our commission mandated a 3% budget cut from our standard budget, which represented about $94,000. That cut reduced the UW faculty research that we funded. You provided a 5% reduction to us, which resulted in $156,000 in change, which was reduced from UW faculty support. 1.5% for the penny plan, just shy of $7,000 was deducted from UW faculty support, and $40,000 was reduced out of commission support. And lastly, the governor's 8% reduction and the enterprise reduction lumped together, $250,000 was taken from UW faculty support. Again, not to overemphasize the fact that we've refocused away from UW traditional academic research, SER, and Mark Northam at the School of Image Resources picks up that work and continues that basic science, but our focus has shifted almost totally to the applied side. And then on slide number 7.
Senator Summers.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just remind me what faculty support is, just what is that? That is that faculty research? Is that what that is?
Mr.
Are those
Chair,
grant dollars that UW provides to that research? So just,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Summers, those are not grant dollars. Those are supplemental dollars that go to supplement basic science research at UW. So, for example, in the petroleum engineering or chemical engineering department, we would fund or partially fund specific projects. And the UW is picking that up, and that is made up primarily from outside dollars leveraged at the University of Wyoming. Slide 7 indicates that the actual physical cuts, not in dollars, as we've reduced our faculty research support from 4 researchers to 1, and our prior staff numbers of 19 have been reduced to 12. We have made the cuts. And we're still operational. Because of the pivot, we are allowed to still meet and able to still meet our mission with these cuts. Future cuts would impact our ability to do projects in the field and to maintain our staff. And I greatly appreciate your attention.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Carpenter, you say there, you point out there that it would affect the ability to complete applied projects. I'm assuming that that's projects that you have ongoing that you're participating in currently. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Larson, yes and no. It would mean some of the projects, they vary in duration. Some of them are relatively short, some are long. Based on the current budget that we have, we believe we can do the projects that we have on our slate. If we have to take reductions, we'd have to prioritize and make a judgment on a project-by-project basis on what projects may or may not be affected.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Carpenter, is it possible to kind of get a list of what projects you got going and who, and or is that proprietary? Or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Larson, certainly it's not proprietary. We have a list. That list varies in size based on the type of project we have. I have, as Chairman Fitzsimmons indicated, a much larger presentation I would be happy to submit for the record. We don't have it with us today because of time constraints. Those projects range from, well, currently I can share with you in 2016, we completed 40 specific projects. And if you'll bear with me for 1 second, there were 40 specific field projects that were implemented. Again, those projects range from one-day field test to a week chemical tracer test to a long-term feasibility study. In addition, we evaluated 9 new technologies. As you can imagine, we have people who come to our institute that try to convince us that they have found a way to violate Newtonian physics. So one of the things that we have to do is make sure that those technologies that are coming to us meet the litmus test, and they're not voodoo science and black magic. We evaluated 9 of those technologies last year, and we wrote about 24 papers, technical reports, and prepared maps for Wyoming developers that can be used for moving forward. So, again, I can provide a more detailed work of what we do for this committee in the very near future, if you'd like.
Thank you.
Representative Schwartz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, of the projects that don't defy the laws of physics, do you have any sense of the return on investment, or is it how far out do we have to go before we can accurately figure that out?
Chairman Nichols, Representative Schwartz, the easy answer is it's a shorter term than academic return. And one of the reasons why we've pivoted away from academic research is much of that basic science research takes years. So the technology evaluation that we do, the expectation is that the technology provider has the technology advanced enough that what they need is an initial pilot project. So what our job, for lack of a better word, is to act as a matchmaker. So we evaluate the technology, and then one of the other tools that the Institute have is called the WIRIT, Wyoming Reservoir Information Tool. It's a free web-based system that allows people to look at Wyoming fields and say, if you were a technology provider, you wouldn't have your technology applied to every field. You'd have certain criteria. It has to be a water flood versus a CO2 flood. It has to be this deep. It has to be overpressured or underpressured. So we look at those technologies, and then we screen to say how big is the market in Wyoming. When we do that, we generate a list of potential Wyoming operators. And so then our job is to reach out to those operators and say, we have a technology that may be applicable for your field. So this is a long-winded answer to answer your question. Some of these technologies don't pan out. We've had technologies that come in that we don't waste our time because they're black magic. We have several technologies that we've looked at However, there aren't appropriate Wyoming fields that meet their technical criteria, so they haven't moved forward. We do, however, of the nine, I would say three-quarters of those, six of them, are viable technologies that we're currently either reaching out to however many operators in Wyoming it applies to and trying to put that technology provider and the Wyoming operator together and allowing them to move forward. The difficulty in me answering your question is our job stops once we've made the first date and they've agreed to move forward. We can, but we currently don't follow along because it then becomes proprietary operating of what technology you put down whole, what are your operating costs. I would say the likelihood of there being a return is significant, and the likelihood of that being shorter in terms of weeks and months versus year on the academic side is real.
Mr. Kochman.
The reason for my body language is because I was confused, and the reason I was confused was because your budget is not laid out in the budget book like any other budget. And I'm still trying to figure out why. It is general fund money that you get, and you've got, you know, some 100 series, then you've got the vast majority of it is 200 series, but you don't have the other usual details in there, like in-state travel, out-of-state travel, office expenses, a breakdown of employees, you know, the retirement, the health benefits, and all that. And I'm kind of curious as to why not.
Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Burns, the answer to that is we are funded out of general fund as a block grant, very similar to the University of Wyoming.
Okay.
And so what you see is a block grant budget versus a traditional general fund budget.
Which is why you gave it to us on this handout instead.
That is correct.
And that's statutory?
Yes, sir.
Why?
Ask us.
We're the ones who've done it. Mr. Chair, with all due respect, that would be my response. I'm only responding to statute.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, where's the president when I need him?
Mr. Chair, if I could, I'd like follow up on Representative Schwartz's question. One of the challenges that we have is we don't own the projects for the life of the project, and I think Steve shared that. So for us to quantify what's the return to the state is very difficult, and I think it would be like sticking our finger on a dot of mercury. It would just splat out. I do have one example that I think our commission can take some pride of ownership on, and that is the Big Sand Draw CO2 flood was owned by an operator that was an MLP, Master Limited Partnership. They don't invest in projects. They distribute their cash flow to their unit holders. We identified that field as a prime candidate for CO2 recovery, and we also identified that Devon Energy had their CO2 line running through that field, and we helped facilitate a discussion to share 3D seismic from the owner of the field to Devon Energy, and through that facilitation, they developed a relationship in which a negotiated sale had occurred without it going to a broad market. And one of the challenges that we have in the state is many of these legacy oil fields that we have, in particular in the Bighorn Basin, are being sold to companies that that aren't traditional investors in long-term projects. And so I think part of the effort that we have in EORI and ERRC is to reach out to these operators and help them do some of the early studies, the mathematical studies and the modeling, to compel their boards and their principals to move forward with the project. And so we hope that we can continue to do that. To quantify the return is really hard. It's soft.
Further questions? So obviously a lot of us are new to you, and I've heard the presentation before, but what my thought process is we need to know more about all of this, and obviously markups next week. So we don't have time to learn what we need to know to learn more about what we're going to do and how we want to proceed, I don't think, as a group. But we look forward to a more full-time presentation in the future, when we get a better handle on just the use of the dollars and have a chance to review the statutes and figure out exactly the best case scenario and have, you know, what you've done in the past and, when you're, and the changes that you've recently made. So we have a little homework on our part, I think, to do that.
Mr. Chairman, I stand ready to support in any way we can. As I said, I can provide that. I know you have an extremely busy schedule, but I'll be more than happy to come back to Cheyenne at your direction.
Anything else? I'm sure that the president will enlighten us when he has the chance as well. All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate
it. Thank you.
With that, I don't see anyone that wants any public comment. So I think we can go off the record, and let's have a little discussion about tomorrow, about more tonight if we want to do so. And we'll